Support it, please.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When the poet Paul Muldoon sets his mind to the task of describing the fast-moving floodwater left behind by a hurricane, he's able to note all that tumbles past him, what's in the water, what's in his mind, what's in his memory, what's in the history that he inherits. It is as precise as family and as broad as humanity, and it rushes across the pages with all the accumulated dirt and clay and hay and hair of the preceding poems and the poets. It is an exhausting ride. And then there's another poem in the book. It's a poem he calls The Breather. And Doug, maybe you can just get rid of the theme music here. Don't need that sort of trumpet noise. Think of this gravestone as a long, low chair, strategically placed at a turn in the stair. Muldoon's latest book of poems, his ninth collection, is entitled Moy, Sand, and Gravel. The poems build not only on Muldoon's previous work, but also on the writing of other poets. Connection listeners, is poetry something that by necessity builds on the work of others? Is an Irishman like Muldoon always to be seen and read in the shadow of the great Irish poets that come before him? Or can one be, can he be, through his distinctive use of language, a poet all on one's own? That's your question, Connection listeners. Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Paul Muldoon is professor in the humanities at Princeton University and professor of poetry at Oxford. And he's in the studio with me this morning. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure to be here.
I have a funny feeling that if I asked you to answer those questions that I posed to our listeners, I could just leave the studio now.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. I mean, those are always the most difficult questions, of course. And it's very hard to find answers to them. And I suppose that's one of the things we're attempting to do, is to try and find answers, provisional though they might be. If you ask me about it, I'd say that at some level, all poems are in conversation with all other poems, in verse or prose. And in fact, here I'm beginning to quote Robert Frost, the great American poet who's one of my heroes. He said somewhere along the way that all poems are in dialogue with all other poems ever written. So, of course, that's a way of talking about the continuation of a tradition. It would be wonderful to think that one's own poor efforts might indeed belong to some tradition. It would be a delight to think that might be the case. So we'll have to wait and see.
Now, when you put together your latest collection, Paul, Moy, Sand, and Gravel, you put the poems in order on purpose. It's clear the further you go through the collection. I thought perhaps, just in the interest of trying to stick with your original intention, I might get you to start at the beginning and read a poem that you call Hard Drive. It's the first one in the collection. Would you do that for us?
Hard Drive. With my back to the wall and a foot in the door and my shoulder to the wheel, I would drive through Seskenore. With an ear to the ground and my neck on the block, I would tend to my wound in Belik and Belnalek. With a toe in the water and a nose for trouble and an eye to the future, I would drive through Derryfubble and Dunamunna and Ballinasgreen, keeping that wound green.
I don't know the places that you're describing here, but I gather they're all in one very small, concentrated part of Ireland. Am I right?
That's right. One tiny little area of Northern Ireland, which is where I was brought up myself, on the border between counties Armagh and Tyrone. Belik and Belnalek are actually in County Fermanagh, just a little bit away. But the other places are in Armagh and Tyrone. It was actually from Fermanagh that my own family came, probably about 100 years ago, into County Tyrone. And then about 40 years ago, our particular branch moved into County Armagh, about 10 miles down the road. But 10 miles in Ireland is a huge, huge distance, and often a virtually impassable distance, and one that we found quite hard to make. a move of such a brief distance, I'm afraid. My mother was the school teacher in a place called College Lands, and we'd moved, as I say, about 10 miles. But at some level, we never quite belonged there, partly, I think, because she was the school teacher. And partly because, as I think is the case with most rural and perhaps even urban areas, one doesn't quite belong until one has maybe a couple of generations in the local graveyard.
And you were about how old when that move was made, Paul?
I was about 4 when that happened. So
your recollection of the place that you'd left is pretty dim.
It's dim, but I do have some memories of it. Of the house that I was lived in first when I was a child, and I suppose some of the most powerful memories that one has, of course, are from those very earliest years. I have a 3-year-old son myself, and I'm always intrigued by this notion of what he is going to remember down the road. I remember things like with a tiny little shop, which my father, well, to say kept is perhaps a bit of an overstatement. I think many of the locals had goods on tick, and I think actually he lost money in it finally.
On tick is on credit?
On credit. But there was a woman who used to come round and get some sweets, candies, that's to say, and I would run round the back of the house and be waiting for her at the back gate. So that kind of memory, the memory of being stepped on by a horse, which I suppose is nowadays rare enough.
Less likely to happen. I noticed that in this new collection, and perhaps in collections preceding it, though, I don't know about that, that you refer often to your family, to your daughter, to your son, to your wife. They are important characters in the poetry that you're producing. Is that because your best stuff comes from sort of dead center, and that's where a 1-year-old or a 2-year-old son is for a young father?
Oh, I think absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right, first of all, about this notion, as you put your hand to your chest, that notion of the dead or indeed the live center and some connection with that, some connection with the emotional core of one's being, I think is vital. It may not always display itself. In other words, there may be more of the head than the heart in some poems. But finally, I think it's the heart that matters. And the connection with where one comes from, and in the case of this book, that covers quite a wide range. It covers my memories of growing up in the 1950s in Ireland, but also the place I now come from, which is New Jersey, just outside Princeton, and along the banks of the Delaware and Raritan Canal. And to make sense of oneself and the place that one comes from, and one's family, one's parents, one's children, is, I think, something that we all, quite irrespective of whether or not we're writers, have to do through the course of our lives. I mean, many people spend large stretches of their adult lives making sense of their childhoods. You know, they may be doing it on an analyst's couch. They may be doing it through the course of writing a poem. It's all part of the same activity. Making sense of things insofar as we can manage it is what the activity is about. So, of course, one of the extraordinary things about children, or at least it seems to me to be quite extraordinary, but having children, is that I always feel that I've missed my life in some way the first time round. One's not really conscious of what's happening to one through the course of one's own life. And it's as if one can, take part in that business of learning the world through someone else.
It's a fascinating observation. My daughter got off the airplane yesterday from university, and I met her in the airport and felt, as I embraced her, that same sense of being the child as I felt of being the parent. I wonder, I mean, I want people to hear you read a little bit more, because there's a lot more here. One of my favorites is The Loaf on page 51, if you can turn to that, because it's, well, I won't say anything about it. I'm just going to let you read
okay.
the loaf.
Well, maybe I should say a word or two about it, and, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, of course.
Just to prepare the ground a little bit, because one of the things about hearing poems is that they do tend to fly by one's ear, and it's good if one has some little preliminary way of getting into them. This is set on the Delaware and Raritan Canal, which I mentioned there a moment ago, in the house that we live in, which is a house built in the 1750s, part of it in the 1810s or 20s. And in those days, of course, when they were building a house, they often incorporated some horse hair into the plaster to stiffen it, to bind it. And so that from time to time, if we have a hole in the wall, as we do from time to time, for various reasons, doing a little bit of work in the house, one's conscious of that horsehair. So this is a series of sensations through a little hole in the wall. And it is a very strange little refrain, which is borderline sense and nonsense, which again is what we're involved with. Anyway, the loaf. When I put my finger to the hole, they've cut for a dimmer switch in a wall of plaster stiffened with horse hair. It seems I've scratched a 200-year-old itch with a pink and a pink and a pinky pick. When I put my ear to the hole, I'm suddenly aware of spades and shovels turning up the gain all the way from Raritan to the Delaware with a clink and a clink and a clinky click. When I put my nose to the hole, I smell the floodplain of the canal after a hurricane, and the spots of green grass where thousands of Irish have lain, with a stink and a stink and a stinky stick. When I put my eye to the hole, I see one holding horse dung to the rain, in the hope, indeed, indeed, of washing out a few whole ears of grain with a wink and a wink and a winky wick. And when I do at last succeed in putting my mouth to the horsehair-fringed niche, I can taste the small loaf of bread he baked from that whole seed with a link and a link and a linky lick.
Paul Muldoon, reading from his new collection of poems, Moisand and Gravel. That one's called The Loaf. And it does connect you very much with the past. It really is your ability to take us through that the hole in the plaster back.
Well, I hope so. I certainly, one doesn't quite know exactly what one's doing as one's sitting down to write a poem. It's really only through the process of writing it, at least in my experience, that one finds out what it's about. But I think I was always very conscious of some connection, first of all, with these thousands of Irish men who died during the course of building this canal. And I'm very conscious of their spirits, however strange that may sound. Hear them talking in Irish, which they were probably speaking in the 1830s when they were working there. So I do feel very connected to them.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is Paul Muldoon, and we're discussing his new collection of poems called Moy, Sand and Gravel. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, professor in the humanities at Princeton University, professor of poetry at Oxford University, winner of the T.S. Eliot Prize, winner of the Irish Times Poetry Prize, Paul Muldoon. What do you put on your business card? Poet? Teacher?
I have a couple of cards. One of them is a Princeton University card where my long title, such as it is printed. And the other is just my name. It's very, very strange. Great question. I hesitate from describing myself as a poet. I think if one were a poet at all, it would only be in the course of attempting to write a poem, you know? I certainly don't walk around thinking of myself as a poet. It seems too great a, a job description somehow to take on, you know?
Either you're being extremely modest or you have this thing in your mind where you could really only become a poet after you're dead.
You know, it's not modesty at all. It's an awareness, I think, just of how little one's own self has to do with the business of writing poems. But I really do believe that if one's lucky, something else takes over. You know, you give yourself over to the power of the language, to what used to be described, I suppose, as inspiration. You know, one's a channel for something beyond oneself. So in that sense, it's not false modesty at all. It's a real realization, I think, just of how little a role one plays in it oneself.
But aside from the mystical side of waiting for something to happen,
mm-hmm.
is all the scaffolding, the architecture, the foundation that you need to have to present the words in the way that you present them, because that's not an accident.
Well, that's absolutely right. One gives oneself over to unknowing, what one does not know. And that's the subconscious, the unconscious, the writing part. But as you say, there's also the reading part. And both of those parts are combined in one person, the person through whom the poem is written. And the reading part needs so much more intelligence, really, and so much more knowing, by contrast, compared to that unknowing, than most of us would ever be capable of managing. But to try to negotiate between the two is what we're attempting, to try to read as the writing is coming out, to make sense of it, to determine if someone else is going to make sense of it.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join me and Paul Muldoon this hour. We're going to Columbia, South Carolina. Mark's joining us. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
It's great to be on the line talking to Mr. Muldoon and you. Mr. Muldoon, I love your poetry, I got to say.
Well, thank you very much.
Sometimes I find it, I have to say, a bit hard to get to.
I've heard of that also.
Yeah, I'm sure you have, but that doesn't bother me in the least, because I always find there's something to enjoy about every one of your poems, the music especially, the sound. And, of course, though I'm an American and speak with no brogue and have no brogue, I still try to imagine it being read with that, you know. I also like the way you bring in steel, perhaps, lines from other poets' poetry, giving your due to tradition. And I was just looking at a poem, Middaw Street, Whiston. You begin with a line from, Maysville's Cargos.
Yes.
Quinquereme of Nineveh from distant Ophir.
Yes.
What's that all about?
Well, you know, that, as you say, first of all, thank you very much for your kind words about the poems. That's a poem I wrote, or at least was published in a book in 1987. And it's set in a house in Brooklyn, 7 Middaw Street, as you say, where, as you know, W.H. Auden, Gypsy Rose Lee, Salvador Dali, Chester Kallman, Peter Peers, Benjamin Britten were all living together, plus one or two chimpanzees, I think, and maybe a rattlesnake or two, a menagerie. And I was quite interested in setting some of these people down and seeing what they would say to each other. And I began there with that quotation, as you say, from John Masefield and his poem Cargos, where he sets the magnificence, the splendour of the great five, the ship with the five banks of oars, the quinquereme of Nineveh from distant Ophir. And then he compares that with the sort of the dirty little, rusty little freighter with its cargo of cheap trays and various knickknacks. So I wanted to begin. Masefield was a favourite poem of mine, when I was growing up, favourite poet of my mother's. And I suppose he was much in the time when this poem was set, 1940, a well-known poet. And I set set off with that image, because it is, after all, set on a ship coming into New York Harbour with W.H. Auden and Benjamin Britten on board as they flee Europe. So that's partly what was going on in my mind. But you're right, there are many references to other poems. I suppose, you know, they're rattling around there in the back of the head. And frankly, they're probably much better than anything one would come up with oneself.
It's a wonderful line. It's a wonderful line.
Mark, you said something about the music.
Oh, yeah.
Of Paul's poetry.
I think Mr. Muldoon has a very distinctive sound. It's the way he snaps his rhymes and his off rhymes at the end. He achieves this. Well, let me just go ahead and just blatantly gush with admiration. This wit that comes with lines. I'm looking at the poem Glanders right now, and it's just the imagery so beautiful of this fellow Larry Toll, who's a bit of a shaman, and the very last stanza.
Go ahead, read it.
Well, it takes it sort of in medias res, but I'll take the last two. He's you have to see him. Someone's coming to him for treatment. He's a shaman, and he's puffing on his pipe, and the smoke is a cloud around his head and going down his chimney, and the smoke goes to Larry's ankle or to Larry's wrist. He would conjure up a poultice of soot and spit, flannel talk, how he had a soft spot for the mud of Flanders, how he came within that of the cure for glanders from a Suffolk man who suddenly went west. That, you know, Flanders was a terrible battle, and how he just missed it within that, the cure for glanders. That bit of indirection, I find, you know, is just wonderful.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. Glanders is, of course, a word that we're probably not too familiar with. It's a particular disease in horses, and I mentioned how one of my earliest memories was of being stepped on by a horse, and I think they must have left their mark on me. And so the whole society in which these cures were prevalent was the society in which I was brought up. Funnily enough, I've just been writing an introduction to W.B. Yeats's Irish Fairy and Folk Tales, which the Modern Library is going to reissue early next year. And as writing, I've just been very conscious of the fact that, you know, various members of my family and, of course, the neighbours were themselves essentially shamans. You know, they had cures for ringworm. People would come to them with various complaints. They would, one of them, a man called Denny McCool, would divine a well. He was a dowser, as well as having a cure for ringworm. It was a society, it's only 50 years ago, and it's changed, of course, quite dramatically over those 50 years. But I'm sure even now there's still the relics of that ancient world picture.
Mark, thanks a lot for your call. Nice to have you on the program. Mark makes a reference to the way, and I did earlier in the program, that you stand beside or behind or underneath or on the shoulders of other poets in the creation of the verse, and the long piece in Moist Sand and Gravel is at the sign of the Black Horse, September 1999, and I demonstrate none of my own wisdom here except the fact that I was able to see in the flyleaf that it borrows from William Butler Yeats' A Prayer for My Daughter.
Right. Well, it's certainly a nod, or more than a nod, in that direction. I suppose one of a poet like W.B. Yeats is head and shoulders above the rest of us to such an extent that in many ways he's ignored rather than addressed by other poets. He's just too daunting at some level, not to take on, but even to allude to. And yet somehow I think one has to take into account the fact that he's there. One simply cannot ignore him. So one aspect of this poem has to do with it being a remake, and I'm sure a very poor remake, of his poem, A Prayer for My Daughter, which describes the child in the cradle.
Well, I have the beginning here. Why don't
I do
the beginning,
sure,
of the Yeats poem, and then perhaps we can hear yours. Yeats begins his poem, A Prayer for My Daughter, the following way. Once more the storm is howling, and half hid under this cradle hood and coverlid, my child sleeps on. There is no obstacle but Gregory's wood and one bare hill, whereby the haystack and roof-leveling wind bred on the Atlantic can be stayed. And for an hour I have walked and prayed because of the great gloom that is in my mind.
It's fantastic, isn't it? Quite extraordinary.
He has a future.
Well, you know, one of the things I try to do here, actually, is to take his rhymes, the stanza form, which is this great eight-line stanza, what I call the stadium stanza.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost as if it's virtually impossible not to sound quite impressive, much more impressive than one is in that particular form. Anyhow, awesome, the morning after Hurricane Floyd, to sit out in our driveway and gawk at yet another canoe or kayak coming down Canal Road, now under 10 feet of water. We've wheeled to the brim the old built-right pram, in which, wrapped in a shawl of Carrickmacross lace and a bonnet of his great-grandmother Sophie's finest needlepoint, Asher sleeps on, as likely as any of us to find a way across the mill-race on which logs, trees more than logs, are borne along, to which the houses down by the old Griggstown locks have given up their inventory. And this goes on, of course, in this vein. I'll read another short little piece of it. I'm happy for once to be left high and dry, happy that the house I may yet bring myself to call mine is set on a 250-year-old slab, happy that, if need be, we might bundle a few belongings into a pillow slip and climb the hill and escape, please examine your change, to a place where the soul might indeed recover radical innocence. A police launch manoeuvring by brought back troops and manoeuvre, a child kin of my children dipping a stale crust in his bowl of kale while listening to his parents complain about the cost of running a household in the Poland of the 1930s. The child who, please hold, a peaked cap would shortly accost for the whereabouts of his uncle, the sofa. So very quickly it gets into this scenario of my Jewish wife's forebears.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
I'm Marjorie Javon and I live in Lexington. And I just wanted to be part of the fun drive, but, you know, it's Christmas time, but if I did it, on a monthly basis, then I could give you more money. I mean, I listen to you all the time. I listen to you in the morning. I just turned you off when the phone rang. I'm an artist. I work in a studio. So if I'm in the studio, I listen. And if I'm, you know, on the way home, I listen to On Point, which is a terrific show. And the This American Life stories, they're wonderful. I mean, they're absolutely wonderful. They're just so quirky and things you'd never hear otherwise. So those I like a lot. I'd say that if you listen to it, you should pledge, because otherwise things like BUR won't be around.
Well, we're going to be around, but it is important that you pledge, because the more you do, the more we can do for you. And we want to thank Marjorie for offering those thoughts and for her support, and especially for her pledge at 1-800-909-9287.
Remember, this is a resource you use each and every day, and we don't send you a bill or an invoice or anything like that. We depend on you to pledge what you think it's worth. So the number to call is 1-800-909-9287, or online you can pledge there as well at WBUR.org. Maybe a pledge of $5 a month is good for you. Maybe $10 a month. Maybe you can go for the $365 pledge and get the Connection fleece jacket and some other great gifts from WBUR. But that just amounts to $1 a day. Now, think of the Connection. What a value. $1 a day for the Connection is quite a bargain. Don't you think, Ted?
Absolutely. 50 cents an hour to find out what's going on in Iraq and what are those 13,000 or 11,000 or 9,000 pages that they handed over the weekend had to say. And now the poetry of Paul Muldoon. Poetry unlike any you're likely to hear just anywhere. 1-800-909-9287. A call and a pledge makes you a part of this effort to continue bringing the programming of your life to you. Whether it's Morning Edition or The Connection or the BBC News Hour, here and now at noon, we're going to hear from Robin in just a few moments. Talk of the Nation at 2, Fresh Air with Terry Gross. I mean, think about it. and then make a call and a pledge at 1-800-909-9287.
One other great thing about the connection is that you, listening, get to participate when you call and ask your questions on the show of the guests. Well, you participate as well in the support of WBUR because listeners do pay half the costs here at the station. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call. This year-end fundraiser is a short one. It's going to end on Wednesday. So now's the time to make your pledge to make sure we're there for you for that whole year of big news stories yet to come. 1-800-909-9287.
That's why you hear me say often, we're funded by you, our listeners. That happens to be the truth. And also by the Massachusetts School of Professional Psychology, hosting an information session for the Doctor of Psychology degree program on Thursday, December 19th. Information at 888-644-MSPP. Ned Numina, partnering with financial companies to transform business challenges into viable e-solutions in Boston and New York, on the web at nednumina.com. And Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. We're grateful for our corporate supporters. But more than half, as Peter just said, of what it takes to keep WBUR coming to you comes from listeners just like you. And when you first tuned in and found WBUR, you should know that listeners who came before you made it possible for us to be there for you. Won't you do the same for brand new listeners yet to come? 1-800-909-9287.
Now, you hear us toss out some different pledge amounts. Just think about $10 a month. What can you get for $10 a month these days? Maybe a half a tank of gas for your car, a movie. Will it even cover a movie and popcorn? I don't think so. But for $10 a month, you just get an incredible wealth of news and information available to you with the flip of a switch, any time of day or night here at WBUR. That's what you're helping to pay for when you call 1-800-909-9287 and make a contribution.
That's right, and not just for the information that keeps you up to date. That's critical. That's why we're here. We're here for the news. But also for the entertainment value of an hour with Paul Muldoon, the poet, or only a game with Bill Littlefield, a remarkable program, or This American Life, or Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Car Talk Guys. I mean, two originals. 1-800-909-9...
To put it mildly, Ted.
Yeah, well, I was going to go away from that. 1-800...
Don't touch that one.
909-9287 makes you a part of this whole thing. And thank you in advance.
Hello, this is Lynn Neary from NPR News. Events and...
909-9287.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Paul Muldoon, professor in the humanities at Princeton University, professor of poetry at Oxford University, author of now 9 collections of poems. The latest is in front of me. It's called Moy, Sand, and Gravel. I keep having to check that just to make sure that I say it right.
I know.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. We invite you in. Now, just before we go to a call, you're talking about nonsense, but the other thing that jumps out from your poetry to me is that you place a high priority on rhyming, on finding not, you know, sometimes just a rhythm, but often words that rhyme, and that's not something that we see so much of in modern poetry.
Well, actually, certainly it has tended to be the case that the 20th century was seen to have been the century in which, as many would have put it, we escaped the constraints of rhyme, the tyranny of rhyme, as it's sometimes known, and that free verse became the dominant mode of the 20th century. Now, it seems to me that indeed is the case, that it became a very significant mode in the 20th century. But that is not to say that rhyme the use of rhyme has disappeared. Now, I talk about the use of rhyme. Again, I'd say it's not that I get up in the morning and decide to use rhyme, though certainly in the last few years, I suppose I'm much more, what would one say, predisposed to doing that. I think more accurately, however corny it might sound, these little chimes in the language find their own ways out into the world. They're intrinsic to the language rather than extraneous to it or extrinsic. They're not imposed upon the language as any advertising person will tell you. If you examine the number of advertisements, for example, that use rhyme even now, it's quite phenomenal. At least 50% of them. The whole song tradition.
Because it's just got that little more velocity that drives it that further into the consciousness?
Absolutely. I think there is a memorability about it. And that, of course, was one of the reasons initially why rhyme was used, or where that feature of the language was valorized, where something was made of it. Because, of course, if in the oral tradition, if one were reciting a poem, it was a way of getting to the end of the next line as a little mnemonic, a little way of remembering where one was meant to be. But it's more than that, I think. And certainly, for me, it's part and parcel of how the language operates. You know, having said that, there are times when I think to myself, heavens, you know, I really should be doing something else. But you know, one has only very, very limited control over that. You know, very limited control.
The other thing about it is that, and I think back to my days as a schoolboy, that rhyme is a way that is used for people to remember. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's easier to dredge back through your memory and come up with a poem that rhymes than it is one that does not. And
well, I think that's true. I think that's true, and I think it's one of the reasons why it's never going to disappear. I don't belong to that school which disparages free verse, absolutely not, nor do I belong to the school, and these two schools are quite powerful, by the way, that says poems must rhyme, and they must use traditional received forms and stanzas. Absolutely not. If either of those things is the first thing to be said about any poem, the chances are that it's not particularly interesting. It should be interesting for some other reason, I think, rather than, you know, the shape it makes in the world.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Raleigh, North Carolina. Dennis is joining us. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, first I want to thank you for taking my call, and I find this a very interesting topic that you're dealing with this morning, because I'm a practicing poet, and I find all kinds of other people's voices entering into what I do, from some of the best poets like Eliot and Pound to my wife, my children. They all seem to be stimulants in a life, and since you're talking about Yeats today, the Mr. Muldoon may know an essay called Mind that Yeats wrote, I think it was sometime in the 20s, where he talked about all kinds of minds coming together into a greater resource out of which the poetry flows. I'm not sure if he's familiar with that essay or not.
Is that the idea of the Spiritus Mundi?
Yes,
it's kind of the world mind, or what they would have called the collective unconscious, I suppose, would be another term for it. So the great storehouse of symbols and images, is that what you're thinking of?
Yes.
Uh-huh,
yes.
Right. Well, yes, uh-huh. Sorry, and, go ahead.
Well, there's also Eliot's essay tradition in The Individual Talent, in which he, basically deals with the same idea, but in terms of psychology, that we're not just one person, but many persons, and of course the many persons that we are all those other people in our lives who have formed us. And those voices speak through us, from our parents to our friends, to songs that we hear on the radio, as you've mentioned, where we do become channels. Sometimes voices come out that we don't even control.
I'm sure that's absolutely the case. Absolutely. And as I say, to give oneself over to that in a significant way is part of the ambition, I think. Mind you,
and humility at the same time, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, we often associate writers with the precise opposite of humility. And I'm sure often, you know, some of us give plenty of reason for that. But humility rather than pride is what's central to the activity, certainly to the activity of writing, being open to this thing that's beyond oneself. And you yourself used the word, the spiritual aspect of writing, which I certainly agree with. That's a major feature of it for me.
1-800-423-8255. Dennis, thanks for that call. to Greensboro, North Carolina. Jim's on the line. Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Paul Muldoon, and I know that you're running out of time, so I'll keep it short.
No, well, thank you very much.
I'm a student, professional, unfortunately, of contemporary Irish poetry, and my faith in poetry has been restored by what's going on in Ireland today. And I'm going to put you on the spot, Mr. Muldoon.
Okay, I like it.
Can you name who some of your favorite contemporary Irish women poets are and why? And
well,
I'll take my comment off the line.
Sure,
thanks for your call, Jim.
Well, there are several, I think, who are absolutely extraordinary. One of them is Maeve McGuckian. I think an amazing poet, difficult poet, but one who I think has really changed the way Irish poetry is operating just now. Elaine Ní Chulainn, another terrific woman poet, both of them actually published by Wake Forest University Press down there in the North Carolina area, great supporter and one of the main presses, indeed, for Irish poetry in the country. Nola Ní Gonnell, who is the preeminent Irish language poet of the moment, is also quite extraordinary. Those are, I think, probably the three women poets who most interest me at the moment.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, on the web at macfound.org, and the Amundsen Foundation for support of the Endowment Fund for NPR West, NPR's new production center in Los Angeles, and the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And boy, are we grateful for that foundation support. However, let me remind you that more than half of what it takes to keep WBUR coming to you comes from people just like you, listeners, at 1-800-909-9287.
Here on The Connection, we bring you familiar voices with new insights. Literary comment by Senator John McCain.
I think that Hemingway will be remembered for his incredible style.
Political criticism by Kurt Vonnegut.
I am afraid that I am like Joe Heller. Joe Heller never voted. He didn't want to be complicit.
I'm Dick Gordon. This morning we're asking for your help, your support, your pledge to help us bring you compelling guests with great stories to tell. So please, phone now.
And the number to call is 1-800-909-9287. You can pledge on the web at WBUR.org. The important thing is that you assess the value of what you're hearing right now and on Morning Edition and on All Things Considered and throughout the day. And then you make a pledge that reflects your support for WBUR.
We've just come through 2 hours of intelligent conversation. We're on our way to Here and Now, the your only noon news magazine on the FM dial here. And it's pledges from listeners just like you that pay for quality programs like this. It's what keeps you coming back. And we need your help now with a pledge at 1-800-909-9287.
Yep, we have $188,000 to go before the end of the fundraiser, and that is Wednesday, which, folks, is the day after tomorrow. And we can do that one pledge at a time. Whatever level you can manage, whether it's $10 a month, $20 a month, $5 a month, if that's it. The important thing is that you join thousands of your fellow listeners in saying, this is the kind of programming I've depended on. I want to help pay for the news.
If you could pay $365 with a pledge, we'll thank you with a Connection fleece jacket, limited edition. Excuse me.
Forest green.
It's
with
in a lovely forest green. That's just a dollar a day. It sounds like a lot when you say 365, but that's just a dollar a day for all the news and all the information that you get each and every day here at WBUR. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call.
You know, for every voice you hear on WBUR, you're getting the reporting, yes, but you're also hearing the work of editors and producers and writers and engineers. And they're all trained in non-inflammatory, calm, declaratory American English to explain, describe, and report news events. That's expensive. Now, we don't shrink from paying what we need to pay to bring you the news, but we need your help to do that. 1-800-909-9287 gets you through, and a pledge at any amount makes you a part of what you're listening to.
You touched on a good point I want to elaborate a bit on, Ted, and that is we don't wait to have the money in hand before we send out the reporters to cover the major news stories for you. We just cover the news, and then we trust that you're going to come through for us right now with a pledge. That's how it works. Just as you trust us to be there for this great news coverage, we have a trust with you to help us pay for it, because listener pledges do pay half the costs. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call to make a contribution, or if you're online, you can do it at WBUR.org.
Robin Young, Anthony Brooks on Here and Now at Noon. 5 years ago, Here and Now did not exist. That's right, that program did not exist. And 2 years ago, there was no On Point with Tom Ashbrook, but WBUR saw the need and stepped up, and then said, let's find the money to pay for it. And listeners just like you came through for us. We want you to join them now at 1-800-909-9287.
I don't have enough free time to read newspapers and magazines, and long ago gave up on television news except in emergencies. I listen to BUR going to work and coming home, and if I'm anywhere near a radio in the early evening, I'll monitor On Point as I go about my chores. I think Tom Ashbrook is incredibly good at what he does. It isn't just the news that hooks me, it's the choice of topics that are discussed on The Connection, On Point, and Inside Out. I also love the issue quizzes on the WBUR website that compare political candidates' views anonymously. Taking them told me a lot about where the contenders stood, more than any other single source, including the debates that were broadcast during the campaign season.
You know, you count on us for reportage just like that. Now we're counting on you to step up with a call and a pledge at 1-800-909-9287. And here with us now is one of the people you'll be hearing in just a couple of minutes on Here and Now, Robin Young. Welcome, Robin.
Hello there. Yes, we're getting the program ready for noon. We've got a lot. There's so much going on. As you and I always say, Ted, the news stream does not stop. So we'll put our foot in again at noon. We're going to take a look at Jon Snow, who's the man who's been involved with the railroad industry, who President Bush has confirmed will be his nomination to replace Paul O'Neill. And he's an interesting character. He comes from the corporate world. He's been talking a lot about corporate governance, but we thought it was interesting. His salary last year was $2 million, and he made, I think, $7 million in stock option bonuses. So will that taint his name? Ted, where are these jobs when we're looking for them? Another million in perks, like he has an aircraft for life. Well, will this taint him as a nominee? So we'll take a look at that story. All the stories that are in the news, we'll update them for you at noon.
Well, we're news people, Robin. That's why we're not going for jobs or running railroads and so on.
Hey, I think I'll go right. Take a look into that one.
Amen.
And, there's a vacancy if Jon Snow gets nominated, Peter.